Welcome and thank you for standing by. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star 1 and record your name. I now turn the conference over to Ms. Alicia Downs. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's COCA conference call entitled Preventing Healthcare-Associated MRSA Infections. We are very pleased to have an expert in the field, Dr. John Jernigan, present on this call. Dr. Jernigan is the team leader for the intervention and evaluation team in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. The objectives for this call: after this activity, the participants will be able to understand the epidemiology of healthcare-associated MRSA infections in the United States, and identify prevention strategies recommended by CDC. In compliance with continuing education requirements, all presenters must disclose any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of unlabeled products or products under investigational use. CDC, our planners, and the presenters for the seminar do not have financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. This presentation does not involve the unlabeled use of a product or product under investigational use. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Jernigan.
Thank you very much, Alicia, and it's my pleasure to address you today on the prevention and control of healthcare-associated methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus in the United States. If you'll go to your, I think, third slide, I think there's a title slide and then a disclaimer slide, and the third slide has a table that's titled Distribution of Top-Ranking Pathogens Associated with NHSN Reportable HAI. That stands for National Healthcare Safety Network Healthcare-Associated Infections. And I wanted just to review for a moment sort of where we are in terms of the burden of MRSA as a pathogen amongst healthcare-associated infections in the United States. And these are data that were recently put together by Alicia Hidron and Scott Fridkin and presented at the recent SHEA meeting earlier this month, which shows data that have been recently reported to CDC through the National Healthcare Associated, National Healthcare Safety Network, and the proportion of various pathogens that are various infections that are caused by various pathogens. If you'll draw your attention over to the column on the right that says total, which gives the total of infections, including central line-associated bloodstream infections, catheter-associated UTIs, ventilator-associated pneumonias, and surgical site infections, most of which are reported through, at least from the device-associated infections, are reported from intensive care units participating in the NHSN. It gives a proportion of those infections caused by the various pathogens. They're not listed by order, unfortunately, but if you look through there, you'll see the most common proportion is CONS, which is coagulase-negative staph, and the second most common one is Staphylococcus aureus. You'll see there in the bottom row, causing about 14.5% of all the healthcare-associated infections that are reported to the CDC, to the NHSN. And also, but not shown on this slide, Dr. Hidron reported that about half of those infections are now caused by methicillin-resistant strains of Staphylococcus aureus. That will vary to some extent by infection type and also by location, higher proportions in ICUs, et cetera. But suffice it to say that about half of all the Staph aureus-causing infections reported in NHSN are caused by methicillin-resistant strains. And if you consider the fact that coagulase-negative staph, which is at the top of this list, which is not as virulent a pathogen as Staph aureus, and also the fact that there may be, through quirks of surveillance definitions, not all of those reported might represent true infections, it's quite possible that Staph aureus might be considered the most important bacteria causing healthcare-associated infections, and now about half of those now are caused by methicillin-resistant strains, which, as we all know, are more difficult to treat, have more limited treatment options, and we'll talk about that in a moment. If you go to the next slide, We also recently reported data from a population-based surveillance system called the Active Bacterial Court Surveillance System run by CDC, which creates population-based estimates, national estimates, on the incidence of invasive bacterial pathogens. And we've been looking in recent years at MRSA as one of those pathogens. These data were reported by Monique Clevens in JAMA last fall. And the estimates were that in the United States in 2005, there were approximately 94,000 invasive MRSA infections in the United States. And this was associated with about 19,000 deaths. These infections were further characterized by whether they were associated with health care or whether they were community associated. And as you can see from the pie graph, about 14% of those were defined as community associated. In other words, occurred in patients who had no discernible recent contact with the healthcare environment. But 86% were, in fact, among patients who had extensive contact with healthcare and presumably acquired colonization and or infection during some contact with healthcare. These data were also corroborated by molecular typing data, which suggested that the epidemiologic definitions were correct. Next slide is entitled, Why is the Emergence of MRSA as a Healthcare Pathogen Important? And I've listed some reasons that I think that should be considered. One, as I've already demonstrated, it's emerged as one of the predominant pathogens in healthcare-associated infections. I mean, I think it's important to keep this in perspective, and what I neglected to say on the first slide is that overall we think that about 8% of the healthcare-associated infections reported to CDC are caused by MRSA. So there are certainly a lot of infections that are caused by other pathogens, but because it's one of the predominant resistant organisms, I think it deserves some attention. Treatment options for this organism are more limited than they are for other organisms, and they have less effectiveness. There are numerous reports that suggest that infection caused by these organisms have higher morbidity and mortality than those infections caused by susceptible Staph aureus infections. And another point that I think is often overlooked is that the high prevalence of MRSA amongst healthcare settings in the United States and across the world today have had a major influence on antibiotic prescribing practices that might be characterized as unfavorable, which further contribute to the spread of resistance. For example, widespread prevalence of MRSA has definitely led to much more widespread use of glycopeptides, such as vancomycin, which has contributed directly, we think, to the emergence of glycopeptide resistance, first in vancomycin-resistant enterococci, and then spread to now vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus, although fortunately that's been the RSA has been a more limited problem today. But even beyond glycopeptides, we're with the newer agents that are available, such as linezolid and daptomycin, these are being used with much greater frequency because of the prevalence of these resistant strains, which will enhance, we believe, resistance to these important agents. And we are already seeing reports of resistant strains that are resistant to these new drugs. Let's go to the next slide. Another reason why the emergence of MRSA as a healthcare pathogen is important is that we think that it actually adds to the overall Staph aureus infection burden. And there are a number of different reports that suggest that this is true. And the implication there is that if we were able to prevent methicillin-resistant Staph aureus infections, we would favorably impact the overall Staph aureus infection rate. And I think, lastly, I believe that the MRSA, the spread of MRSA, has represented a failure that we've seen really across the world in healthcare facilities across the world to contain transmission of drug-resistant bacteria in certain settings. It could be considered a marker for our ability to contain transmission of important pathogens in the healthcare setting and gives us the message that we need to do better at preventing transmission. I also would like to say that learning how to successfully control MRSA will likely have benefits that extend beyond just MRSA and beyond to other pathogens. Preventing transmission, as we'll talk about in the next few slides, is an important part of controlling antimicrobial resistance. and the principles that are likely to be successful in preventing MRSA transmission are principles that are likely to apply to many, many different pathogens that we'd like to prevent spread of in the healthcare setting. The next slide. Why is it that I can say that this has been primarily a problem of transmission and it's a marker for our lack of success in controlling transmission of MRSA?
Please have your passcode and conference leader's name available. A coordinator will assist you momentarily.
Are you still there? I hope you're still there. I'll keep talking. The next slide is titled, The Emergence of MRSA has been due to transmission of relatively few clones, not de novo selection. And these are data that were published by Dr. Hiramatsu several years ago that show that there are really a limited number of major clonotypes of MRSA at that time that have been circulating in the world. MRSA is not born commonly out of strains of Staph aureus that are sensitive. It's not that you have a patient who's colonized with sensitive Staph aureus and you give them an antibiotic and that sensitive Staph aureus turns into a methicillin-resistant strain. That's not what happens. What happens is methicillin-sensitive strains acquired the genetic machinery to make them methicillin-resistant, and we know that that genetic event, according to these molecular epidemiologic data, is quite rare. And in fact, up until the early part of this century, probably it only occurred a handful of times, suggesting that, again, it's transmission of relatively few strains of MRSA all over the world. So if you had a patient with MRSA, you knew that they acquired it from somebody else, essentially. Now, we've seen in recent years, if we go to the next slide, the emergence of MRSA as a cause of infection in people who have no association with healthcare. And there's been a lot of molecular epidemiologic work done there to suggest that these strains actually are different than what we have traditionally seen in healthcare, and that these strains, in fact, probably were born, newly born from methicillin-sensitive strains in the community. And so this event might be occurring with increasing frequency, but still, there are relatively few strains of MRSA that are circulating. And this slide illustrates that most of the community-associated MRSA outbreaks that we've seen are associated with a particular strain that is now seen all over this country. There's also data to suggest that these strains are finding their way into hospitals and being transmitted there and are becoming a more important cause of healthcare-associated infections. But again, we're talking about primarily a problem of transmission of very few strains, so that if we could prevent transmission, we could have a big impact on what's happening with this particular organism. If we go to the next slide, which is titled Key Prevention Strategies, this is a summary of the prevention strategies that we have included as part of our campaign to prevent antimicrobial resistance in healthcare settings. And there are four major categories of prevention strategies. Those are prevent infection, diagnose and treat infection effectively, use antimicrobials wisely, and prevent transmission. I'd like to take a moment to go over these individually. I think I'd like to address first the strategy of preventing infection. And I think it's important to keep in mind that one of the most important strategies for preventing MRSA or any other bacteria or drug-resistant bacteria is to prevent infections from happening in the first place. We have, as we all know, lots of recommendations for prevention of device and procedure-associated infections. As we've seen in recent years, these can be quite effective, and we've achieved really large preventable fractions for healthcare-associated infections. If you go to the next slide, which is a figure that's entitled Trends in Percent MRSA and Incidences of MRSA and MSSA among central line-associated bloodstream infections in ICUs in the United States, from 1997 to 2007. These are data, again, that were put together by Darren Burt and Scott Fritkin, were presented at the annual SHEA meeting earlier this month. And let's take a minute to look at that. And again, these are bloodstream infection rates in the sort of blue and pink lines there. The dark blue is MRSA rates, and the pink line is MSSA rates. And you can see the actual rates of catheter-associated infections amongst hospitals reporting to the NHSN and NIST have been going down for several years now, and that includes both MSSA and MRSA. We need to understand a little bit better what the reasons for this is, but we think that one contributing factor is the concept that hospitals are getting better at preventing all catheter-associated bloodstream infections through some of the prevention guidelines and initiatives that are currently in place. This is in distinction to the green bar at the top of the graph, which shows the proportion of those infections that are caused by methicillin-resistant strains, and this has continued to go up. So we still are seeing a high prevalence of resistance among those strains, but the good news is that at least with device-associated infections, and in this case, central line-associated bloodstream infections, in ICUs mainly, that are reporting to the CDC, we've seen the rates going down, and this is a very, very important thing in the battle against MRSA and any other drug-resistant or, in fact, drug-sensitive organisms. So I want to make the point that this is a very important part of the strategy. It's not the same with all infection types. We have some unpublished data to suggest that MRSA surgical site infection rates, at least for some procedure types, are still on the rise. And so the battle is certainly not won yet. But preventing device and procedure-associated infections is an important cornerstone in the battle against antimicrobial resistance. The next slide reviews those key prevention strategies again. We've talked about preventing infection. I'm not going to say a lot about the next two, which is diagnosing and treating infection effectively and using antimicrobials wisely, which are related. We think that effective diagnosis and effective treatment is a form of using antimicrobials wisely and can lead and direct to using antimicrobials in the most optimal way. Obviously, antibiotic use is another cornerstone in any battle to prevent antimicrobial resistance and does play a role in MRSA control. I'm not going to talk about that a lot today. As I've shown with the molecular epidemiology, transmission is really the key determinant in the spread of antimicrobial of MRSA. It's quite possible that antimicrobial use may influence how rapidly it can spread, and there probably is a role, although there are very few reports of hospitals who have been able to control MRSA simply by altering antimicrobial use, although we need more information in that particular field. But what I would like to move to, and we'll talk some more on, is the final strategy, which is preventing transmission. If you go to the next slide, I've outlined some bullets that I think discuss why preventing transmission is such an important part of MRSA control. The first is that the entire healthcare-associated MRSA problem is caused by spread of a few clones. I've already gone over that by showing you some of the molecular epidemiologic data. So clearly, preventing transmission is going to have a big impact. Also, I think it's important to keep in mind that preventing widespread colonization, even if you're not having many infections, minimizes the circulating pool of resistance genes that can contribute to a cycle of increasing multidrug resistance. For example, the example I've already given is that vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus is likely a direct product of widespread colonization with vancomycin-resistant enterococci and methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and provides the opportunity to share genetic material between those important pathogens to lead to a new important drug-resistant pathogen. So if we could even limit colonization with drug-resistant pathogens, we might help limit the spread and sharing of these genetic determinants. If we were able to decrease the proportion of infections that are caused by antimicrobial-resistant organisms, we improve our antibiograms, and this helps, makes it easier to use more narrow-spectrum antibiotics and eases the pressure for broad-spectrum antibiotic use. Pretty much any patient in hospitals in this country that's suspected of having a hospital-onset bacteremia, MRSA, Staph aureus, has got to be in the differential, and because of the high prevalence of MRSA, it has become standard of care to use broad-spectrum agents that cover that. If the proportion of resistance among those pathogens was low, we might feel more comfortable recommending empiric use of narrow-spectrum antibiotics. And so I think improving these antibiograms helps ease the pressure for use of those broad-spectrum agents and also can help preserve the effectiveness of the antimicrobial agents that do need to be reserved for those infections that are more difficult to treat. And also, lastly, on this slide, preventing colonization actually helps prevent infections. You have to become colonized, acquiring organism, before you can become infected with it. And we know that with MRSA, patients can carry MRSA for some time, and we know that the risk of infection with MRSA is increased by being colonized with it. And many of those infections might happen a long time after they acquire colonization, which might include post-discharge. Susan Huang and others have reported data that suggests that newly colonized patients may have up to a 30% risk of developing an infection in the year following acquisition of colonization, and that many of these infections might occur long after the patient has actually left the hospital and so may not be captured in our usual surveillance systems. If you go to the next slide, which again revisits the ABC's population-based MRSA data, you'll see a pie diagram, and it's titled Most Healthcare-Associated Invasive MRSA Infections Have Their Onset Outside of the Hospital. So you've seen a version of this slide before. Again, 14% of all the invasive MRSA disease in this country is community-associated. But this pie chart further subdivides the healthcare-associated into that has its onset while patients are in the hospital, which is the 28% sort of shaded version that you see, and those that are healthcare-associated but have their onset outside of the hospital, which is the 59% that you see there. So what this pie graph suggests, again, is that 59% of all invasive MRSA disease is both healthcare-associated but doesn't have its onset in the hospital. So most of our hospital-based surveillance systems are capturing mostly that 28% piece of the pie and not this 59%. So many of the patients often are coming back into the hospital with a community-onset infection, which may not be recognized as having a relationship to a previous hospitalization and therefore not really tied to any prevention efforts. So that's one reason why preventing transmission while patients are in a hospital or in contact with healthcare may be important, because it might have implications in what happens after they leave. So this 59% could be addressed to some extent, although we don't know fully what proportion of these infections are caused by that. But by preventing transmission during contact with healthcare may have a significant impact on this 59% that happen after patients leave. Another reason to focus on preventing acquisition of new colonization when patients are in the healthcare setting. Let's go to the next slide entitled Regional Spheres of Influence Within the Spectrum of Inpatient Care. I think it ties to the last slide in bringing up the point that what we do in a given hospital with regard to preventing transmission or not preventing transmission probably impacts on what happens in other healthcare facilities with whom you might share patients. This shows a series of theoretical or hypothetical hospitals in a region and also nursing homes that are sharing patients one with another. And since patients can acquire colonization, for example, in hospital A, and that may not develop an infection while they're there, but might carry the organism to, say, nursing home 1, serve as a reservoir for transmission there, or that patient is transferred to another hospital B, still colonized with MRSA, might develop an MRSA healthcare-associated infection there that might be related to what happened in hospital A. Just the point that there's an interrelationship amongst healthcare facilities and probably an amplification cycle that happens as healthcare facilities share patients with one another. And there's actually some mathematical modeling data that has looked at these relationships and suggests that it is true that what we do in one hospital has an impact on what happens in other hospitals. And therefore, prevention efforts probably should keep that in mind, so that preventing infection onset in your hospital is definitely a good thing, but it's also important to prevent acquisition of colonization in your hospital, as that might have an impact on what happens to the patient as they travel throughout the healthcare system. Go to the next slide is an example of such mathematical modeling. These are data that were published several years ago using information from the United Kingdom and looking at outbreaks of MRSA caused by a particular outbreak strain that they've entitled eMRSA 15. for the years 1993 to 1998. And what they did is they took some epidemiologic data of spread of this strain and modeled it to suggest what would have happened if various facilities in the United Kingdom had various levels of success in both preventing duration of outbreaks once they occurred in their hospital, and also if we'd prevented transmission of colonized patients from one affected hospital to a hospital that had not yet been affected by this outbreak strain, or both. So that's the line. The dotted line on top talks about 30% duration. The x-axis is the percent of facilities implementing the intervention, so that if 80% of facilities had decreased the transmission within their facility, the duration of the outbreak, by 30% alone, that would have decreased the number of national outbreaks from about 700 to about 400, so, or 350 to 400, almost by 50%. If they were able to prevent transmission from one facility to another by 30%, it would have reduced the number of outbreaks nationally even more. Or if they're able to do both decrease the amount of transmission within their facility and decrease the amount of inter-facility transmission, then we've seen a very deep reduction in the number of outbreaks. So it's just a point to say that we're all sort of in this together, and how well we do nationally at controlling MRSA is very much a product of what we do individually. And what we do as an individual facility will probably have impact on what happens in other healthcare facilities. So we need to keep that in mind in designing our prevention programs. Next slide, entitled How Best to Prevent MRSA Transmission in Healthcare Settings. Well, of course, this is a big question, isn't it, and quite a controversial subject at the moment. I think some of the most controversial questions are, is it better to use standard precautions alone in preventing MRSA transmission, or standard plus barrier contact or barrier precautions, such as contact precautions? There are some out there who argue that we should assume that every patient who comes into our hospital is colonized with MRSA or any number of other drug-resistant or drug-sensitive pathogens, and that we should take the precautions necessary to prevent transmission from that patient to the other. There are others that argue that the use of additional barriers enhances prevention of spread and that we should use that. The CDC guidance currently does recommend use of contact precautions in patients who are recognized to be carriers or infected based upon clinical cultures. There are some that challenge whether contact precautions should be used only on those that are identified by clinical cultures. There is a well-described iceberg effect with MRSA, meaning that if you only rely on cultures that are obtained in the process of clinical care to identify patients who are carriers, you will not recognize a major proportion of those. And that raises the question, should some more active surveillance system, testing of asymptomatically colonized patients who may be at high risk to be carriers, should we do that in order to identify them, in order to guide additional infection control precautions? And if we should do that, in what settings? These are all questions around which, as there's a lot of debate right now. I'm not going to try to solve the debate for you today. I will be happy to answer questions about that. What I would like to do is review what the current CDC guidance is in regard to these important questions. And if we would go to the next slide, that's entitled the HICPAC, which of course stands for Healthcare Infection Control Practice Advisory Committee, which is the Federal Advisory Committee with which we work to develop CDC guidance. The HICPAC guidance on management of multidrug-resistant organisms in healthcare settings, and this of course would include methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. And as you may be aware, CDC currently recommends a two-tiered approach to developing a program to prevent MVROs. And I should say at the outset that the underlying premise here is that there's probably no single magic bullet to defining a program for effective prevention of MVROs that would equally apply to every healthcare setting. There probably is some tailoring that probably needs to occur depending on the type of patient population, the type of setting. and also recognizes that there are some unanswered questions on what the best way to make this happen, and allows for some flexibility in putting together a program that is effective. I will also say, however, that this document is a fact that's often overlooked by many, is that it asks very much of hospitals, and that it asks that hospitals implement a program that is effective and to measure its effectiveness, and if it's not being effective, to do more. And that's where the two-tiered system comes in. So there's a first tier, which describes general recommendations for all acute care settings, and I'm going to focus mainly on acute care settings here today, which is recommended for all acute care settings regardless of their current MDRO problem, MRSA problem. And then if by implementing these general recommendations you're not seeing a decrease in endemic rates, or in the case of a different organism, not MRSA, but another epidemiologically important organism, such as, let's say, for example, if your hospital saw a VRSA for the first time, then the guidance says you should go to a second tier of more intensified recommendations, and we'll go over those in a little bit more detail now. If you go to the next slide, these describe in a general way the components of the first tier. Again, general recommendations for all acute care settings, regardless of their MRSA problem. And number one on the list is are some recommendations on engaging the administration in this problem, first and foremost of which is to make MDRO prevention and control an organizational patient safety priority, and to devote the resources necessary, which can be substantial, into making this happen and to implementing an effective program. I think number two is implementing a multidisciplinary process to monitor and improve adherence of healthcare personnel to the recommended practices, so that you know how well healthcare personnel are actually implementing this first tier of recommendations, and to feed those data back and to implement the processes necessary to get that adherence where it needs to be. And then third, measurement, feedback on facility and patient care unit trends on MDRO incidence and adherence measures as a way of improving practice there. Education and training of personnel is clearly important. In and of itself, it's not sufficient. I've mentioned already judicious use of antimicrobial agents should be one of the cornerstones of a resistance control program. I'm not going to go into great detail of that today. The first-tier recommendations include use of standard precautions for all patients, plus contact precautions for patients who are known to be infected or colonized with MRSA based on clinical cultures. And finally, the idea of measurement, which is key here, monitoring trends over time to determine whether additional interventions are needed. What is the impact that your program is having? And again, if you don't think that you're seeing a decrease in your endemic rates, then the guideline calls for you to consider additional measures. And if you go to the next slide, that outlines what I just said. The indications for moving to a second tier are either the first case of an epidemiologically important MDRO, I gave VRSA as an example, or more apropos to the problem of MRSA, when endemic rates are not decreasing despite implementation of and correct adherence to the first tier measure. So if that's not happening and your measurement shows that you're still having stable or increasing rates, then you should consider second tier measures. And if you go to the next slide, this outlines those intensified interventions for the acute care settings. And it's not that all of these need to be implemented according to the document, but that you should choose from among these, assess how you're doing, and if you're not making an impact, then you should consider additional measures as well. So one of these is the use of active surveillance cultures to identify high-risk patients in high-risk populations that may be carriers of MRSA, or and also to do it at periodic intervals as needed to assess how much transmission is going on in your units. And the document also says that if you're going to take this approach, you should actually implement contact precautions empirically until the results of your surveillance test are back. So in other words, if you're concerned enough about someone to do a surveillance test to find out if they're asymptomatic carriers, you should go ahead and put them in contact precautions until you prove that they're not a carrier. There are additional recommendations in the second tier level for intensifying administrative engagement and some specific suggestions on correcting and addressing systems failures that might be contributing to the problem. Additional recommendations for intensifying education and training of personnel and monitoring adherence. Use of judicious use of antimicrobial agents and monitoring of trends. I'll talk more about that in a moment. One of the things that's to be considered is cohorting of staff to the care of MDRO patients only. Also some recommendations on potentially enhancing environmental measures, including increasing monitoring of how adequately environmental services are being cleaned. The next bullet says consult with experts on a case-by-case basis regarding use of decolonization therapy for patients and staff. And I know that there are probably lots of questions about this. The current CDC guidance document still recommends that this be considered only on a case-by-case basis. It recommends against its routine use. I certainly am familiar with recent studies from Evanston Northwestern that suggest that they've used this approach and saw some success. I think that's a very interesting study, and I think it calls for additional study on this issue. I mean, I think that there's some unanswered questions about to the downsides of doing that, not the least of which would be the emergence of further antimicrobial resistance, and we need to better understand the impact of that. Also, is it best to use that in a targeted fashion versus routinely, et cetera? I think these are unanswered questions. And so the CDC guidance still says that this should not be done routinely, but it is an area that calls for further investigation. I've also had a lot of questions about how this pertains to staff and culturing staff. Again, the current CDC recommendation is not to routinely culture staff for asymptomatic carriage of MRSA, and we can go into the reasons for that. I think there are unanswered questions as to how important that is in terms of a reservoir of transmission in endemic settings in the United States. And the guidance says that if there is epidemiologic evidence that is linking a particular healthcare worker who happens to be colonized with transmission, then in that case it should be considered. But again, only when there's epidemiologic evidence linking them specifically to transmission. And we can talk about that more in the question and answer session. And then lastly, I'd like to point out that the guidance document suggests that if you're unable to limit transmission, even after all those things we talked about, consider actually stopping new admissions to the unit. So the guidance document, I think, tries to be pretty serious about, or lead hospitals to implementing a program that seriously tries to limit transmission of these and other important drugs. Now, if you go to the next slide, that's labeled MDRO and CDAD module. That stands for multidrug-resistant organism and Clostridium difficile-associated disease module, which is a new module that's coming out as an NHSM that provides an opportunity to measure the impact of your control program. One of the problems, or one of the limitations of the current of the HCPCS document that I just went over, is that it doesn't specify what measurements should be used to monitor the impact of your program. And I think that this module is, in some sense, an answer to that. It provides some suggestions on measures that could be used to employ in your hospital to actually monitor how well your MDRO program is doing. And I'd like to review with you for a moment what that module is looking like. Next slide. The organisms that you can monitor within this are MRSA, which is mostly linked to our discussion today, but also there are other organisms that you can see there that there are protocols for. And I'll draw your attention to a URL, a website at the bottom of the slide there that shows where you can go to actually download the protocol for this module if you want to look at it. The module is actually not up and running yet for NHSM users. We anticipate that it will be sometime this summer, but the protocol is finalized, and you can download and actually begin to use that protocol if you want to immediately. And if you plan to, if you are an NHSM member or you plan on joining Using this module, you can begin to collect the data now on paper and retrospectively enter a few months' data at the time the module becomes available online. Next slide. The goal is to provide a mechanism for healthcare facilities to report and analyze data that will inform them of the impact of targeted prevention efforts. The next slide shows some of the reporting requirements and reporting options. Required is infection surveillance. Now remember, let's talk from the perspective of MRSA for the moment. This is not just device-associated or procedure-associated MRSA infection, which is what the existing NHSM modules usually track. This is any infection that's caused by the organism of interest that might occur on the unit in which prevention program is implemented. And after all, we are trying to prevent all infections caused by MRSA, not just those that happen to be associated with a central line or a urinary catheter or a ventilator, for example. Some of the optional measures include what we call a laboratory identified event, which we here is identified as a proxy infection measure. It also may be a proxy for transmission. This is essentially an incidence of all clinical cultures that yielded the organism of interest, for example, MRSA. We have reason to believe that this has some advantages because it might actually, and there are some data suggest that it correlates very highly with actual transmission rates, at least in ICUs, and may be a very useful tool for monitoring transmission or infection in a way that potentially is automatable by extracting information from clinical microbiology databases. There is also the option of measuring process measures such as adherence to hand hygiene, adherence to gown and glove use, and if you're choosing to use active surveillance testing, you can monitor adherence to that. There are also outcome measures for those that are employing the use of active surveillance testing, measures such as actual transmission rates as defined by use of active surveillance or admission prevalence of carriage, et cetera, and so forth. To go to the next slide, entitled NHSM MRSA Metrics, it outlines some of the measures. I won't go over them in great detail. You can see there's an overall nosocomial MRSA infection rate, which is essentially MRSA infections per 1,000 patient days using NHSM definitions. There are incidence rates that are based on clinical cultures, either all cultures that don't distinguish colonization from infection. Again, we think this might be a good surrogate marker for transmission. You can measure the incidence of blood MRSA bloodstream infections or even an option of the admission prevalence of MRSA bloodstream infections. It might be a measure for community onset MRSA bloodstream infections. If you're using active surveillance, there's a measure for direct MRSA acquisition. Again, adherence to process measures, whether that be hand hygiene or contact precautions, or even adherence to obtaining active surveillance testing if you're using that approach. And then finally, you can also measure the device-associated infections that are specific for that pathogen. So, for example, you can measure central line-associated MRSA bloodstream infections as a subset of all MRSA bloodstream infections. So that's just to give you a flavor of what's available in this module that I think that might be helpful to hospitals in implementing CDC guidance to tell whether they're having an impact and whether or not they need to enhance their program by adding the second-tier measures or not. Go to the next slide. I'd like to briefly mention what I think are some opportunities for MRSA prevention research. I think that we need to learn more about where to focus our efforts and whether focusing on high-risk units might have implications for the whole entire hospital. It might be that different programs may be appropriate for different settings within your hospital, ICUs versus non-ICU, for example, and we need to better understand the implications of that. As I've mentioned, there are a lot of questions about the use of topical antimicrobials or antiseptics for eradicating or suppressing Staph aureus colonization. One approach that's being looked at now in a cluster randomized trial is the use of routine chlorhexidine bathing of patients in certain high-risk populations or units to see its impact on transmission of not only MRSA, but other resistant pathogens and maybe even on infections in general. The question of using topical antibiotics for decolonization, most commonly used would be mupirocin, and when and where to do that, and whether there are potential downsides in terms of the emergence of antimicrobial resistance. I think there are lots of questions that need to be answered. I think it's an important area for investigation, and in fact these may be more routinely recommended, but I think we need some more data before we do that. I think understanding the risk factors for those patients who have MRSA infection that's healthcare associated but has its onset after the patient leaves the hospital, and what the relationship between that and previous hospitalizations, and whether our hospital-based prevention programs may actually have impact on those patients, and might whether an important strategy for preventing those is preventing acquisition of new colonization while patients are in contact with acute care stays. I think we should take advantage of and understand better the importance of interfacility transmission and how this contributes to the overall problem, and how the contributions of individual hospitals can contribute to control over a region or a network of hospitals that are sharing patients with one another. Perhaps use of mathematical modeling might be a fruitful strategy for understanding this better. And then lastly, I'll mention that I think novel techniques for changing organizational culture as a means to improve adherence, not only for prevention of transmission of MRSA, but preventing infections of all types of infections in a healthcare setting. I think we need to do a much better job at changing the way healthcare workers in the United States and across the world think and understand about how their behavior impacts the welfare of the patient. And I think if we can begin to do a better job with this, we will most likely have a big impact not only on MRSA, but all sorts of other problems as well. So next slide, in conclusion, I'd like to say that I think that the burden of MRSA remains high in U.S. healthcare settings. We are seeing the emergence of community-associated MRSA, or they have emerged in many areas. But the best population-based estimates that we have suggest that most invasive MRSA infections are healthcare-associated. And so we need to do a better job at preventing healthcare-associated MRSA infections. Epidemic strains of MRSA that are originally associated with the community have emerged as important causes of hospital-acquired infections. But again, more reason to prevent transmission of these important pathogens in patients who come in contact with the healthcare setting. I think there's emerging evidence that MRSA infections and transmission can be prevented, and we are seeing some successes, as I've shown, even in endemic settings in the United States. And I think we need to learn more about the techniques and prevention programs that are most successful and to facilitate their spread even further in the United States. I think infection control programs have to be multifaceted, and there has to be broad institutional commitment, including the measurement of impact and changing your strategy if you're not having the desired impact. And I think there's no one-size-fits-all, and there's no single magic bullet. This problem is going to take attacking on multiple fronts using multiple concurrent strategies, and I think that's what the CDC guidance tries to do. And sometimes it's difficult to tease out the specific contribution of those individual components. And we may not be able to do that for some time. So I think we're going to have to be satisfied with trying a lot of different things at once and monitoring impact and adjusting as need be to have the desired effect. Next slide, I'd like to just acknowledge many people at the CDC and beyond have contributed to the information I've included in this talk. And thank you very much for your attention. And I'll be happy to stay online. I know we're near the end of our time, but since we got a late start, happy to stay on for a few minutes and answer any questions that may be out there. Thank you very much.
Welcome, and thank you for standing by. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your name. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, press star 2. Again, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone and record your name. One moment, please, while we wait for the first question.
Hello?
We have a question from Ona Montgomery. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi there. I appreciate this content very much. It was very helpful, and I appreciate especially discussion of the metrics for measuring effectiveness. In the VA, of course, we're hard into this, and one of the things that we're torn with is determining what methods to measure are used for our active surveillance cultures. We've been using Chrome Auger, and it has a pretty high sensitivity. There's some pressure to start using PCR for the benefit of more rapid identification and more rapid institution of isolation, but it's my understanding that the sensitivity is a little bit less. So we're kind of torn with this idea of getting the most accurate information versus faster information. And some sites are actually using PCR for admission testing, and then at discharge or transfer using Chrome Auger, because it's not so urgent to know that answer, which may falsely elevate the transmission rates and not give very accurate information about the effectiveness of control measures. So I was interested in anyone's opinion on that.
Yeah, I think there are some issues. If you're using active surveillance culture to determine a transmission rate, there are some issues about using different tests for an admission culture, for example. And if you're doing admission and discharge or transfer cultures to try to direct that measure, there should be some consideration to differences in sensitivities of the test that might impact the measure. You know, again, there's limited experience with a number of these measures, and I don't think we have all the, you know, the right answers to them right yet. And that particular measure, the transmission rate as defined by active surveillance cultures, I think it can be, at least I hear from a number of hospitals that they think it can be of use in terms of, helping increase an awareness of patients who may have, you know, acquired an organism in their unit that they didn't have when they came there, and it's a way of making something more visible that was completely invisible before. I think we need more experience with that measure to understand exactly what it means and exactly what the implications of different sensitivities of these tests have for that. So I think, you know, we're early on in the phase on that, and I think in the in a document that's coming out with that is actually a SHEA, an IDSA a position paper on some of these measures that are consistent with what's going into the NHSN module, I think has some verbiage in there that suggests that if you are going to use this for measuring the actual transmission, you should give some consideration to using the same test both at the admission and the discharge to make that happen. In terms of which test is better, I don't know the answer to that. And I think probably there's, if you're using active surveillance, I think that, you know, there are certainly examples of facilities that have shown some success using active surveillance that uses you know, either technique, and obviously there's a lot of questions that remain unanswered about what the exact role of active surveillance is in general, and in particular which test to use and where. So I don't have a lot of great answers for you there, and I think there are a lot of unanswered questions. But take a look at this protocol and this document that will be a SHEA IDSA statement that we anticipate will be published later this year that might address some of those questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joyce Frederick. Ma'am, your line is open.
This also is a VA question. We've been entering data into the IPAC system for the VA for various outcome numbers for the MRSA surveillance that we're doing. Is that being coordinated with this new NIST National Health Surveillance Program at all, or I hate to get into double data entry anytime, any place, since I was wondering if you already have access to all that data that's being collected.
I can't speak to what the plans for that VA data collection system are. So I can't answer that question. I will say the protocol is available online, and if there's desire to sort of harmonize those measures, the opportunity certainly is there.
Sam, does that answer your question?
As probably as well as it can be answered.
Thank you, ma'am. Our next question comes from Dr. Shelley Traskovich. Dr. Traskovich, your line is open.
Hi. This is, I guess, it's sort of a question. Sometimes when a doctor is a patient, you get a really different perspective of things. And I used to have a pancreas transplant, and so I got to observe things from a different point of view. And I noticed that a lot of times the physicians did not wash their hands. And this was on a floor where there was a lot of methicillin-resistant staff. The infectious disease physicians they washed their hands when they came in, and the dermatologists did, the people who were putting their hand, touching the rashes. But I was just amazed. This is at a university hospital. So I guess if it's going to be a question, how do you get doctors to actually do what they're supposed to do?
Well, thank you for the question. Of course, it's a problem we've been struggling with for 150 years since the time of Semmelweis, when we demonstrated that hand hygiene was important. I think that there are a number of healthcare facilities who've made tremendous strides in improving adherence and getting adherence levels that approach 100%. And I think we should do a better job at sharing those strategies that have been implemented in those hospitals with other healthcare facilities, because chances are they may have there may be pieces of that other healthcare facilities may find useful. I think it gets a little bit to this idea that I mentioned of finding ways to change organizational culture and the way healthcare workers think in general. I think there's a lot of work to be done to make that happen. I think it is happening in a lot of places. I think we've got a long way to go, I don't have a simple answer to that question, but there are many hospitals out there who have done a very good job, and there are tools available to help individual hospitals increase adherence.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Mr. Mejia. Mr. Mejia, your line is open.
Thank you. Yes, this is in Miami, and I have a question. It's sort of, I think, more on the microbiological realm. And we have recently two cases of MRSA that, to us, they were very closely related in the same school. And my question is there a way to confirm that actually one case was passed to another person, I mean, by fingerprint or any other technique, that we can confirm 100% that this infection was acquired by this individual from this other individual? Would that be possible?
I'm not sure whether you're talking about a community case or a healthcare associated case.
I'm sorry, I can explain a little bit more. It's two community acquired cases in a particular school, two children diagnosed with MRSA infection and actually confirmed by laboratory with antibiogram done. But then we wanted to do fingerprint and we couldn't do it because they threw away the isolates. But I still question the utility of that practice if we had been able to do it, because we wanted to determine if one had passed it on to the other. And I still don't know if that determination is possible.
The focus of this is mainly on healthcare-associated MRSA, but I will say that community-associated MRSA skin and soft tissue infection is very, 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 very common in this country. I mean, we think that there are millions of skin and soft tissue infections that are caused by MRSA in this country. And as I pointed out, many of them are caused by very closely related, if not exactly the same strain. And just because two children in the same school both have an MRSA infection does not necessarily imply that there was some sort of transmission there. If there were some concern that the local health department would be the one to investigate such a thing.
Okay, thanks.
Hello.
Our next question comes from Ann Connolly. Your line is open.
Hi. A colleague of mine who couldn't participate today asked me to ask a question. And her question is, are people who have had a MRSA infection in the past, whether it's community or healthcare associated, are they more likely to or at a higher risk for contracting a MRSA infection in the future?
There certainly is, particularly on the community associated side, there is some evidence of recurrent infection among certain individuals, whether that's due to a patient being reinfected by the strain that they continue to carry after that infection, or whether that is due to transmission within, say, a household cluster where they are spreading it from one person to another and then back to another. But there is some evidence that MRSA infection can recur. We see this more commonly on the community-associated side, but it certainly happens in healthcare as well. You know, somewhere around 10%, we think, of MRSA bacteremias in the population-based surveillance that I mentioned are, in fact, recurrent infections, which may be due, we don't know the reasons for that completely, but probably there are a number of factors explaining that. One might be failure to remove indwelling intravenous catheters that may still have biofilm on them and recrudescence from that aspect, perhaps inadequate treatment, perhaps unrecognized occult sources of infection that were incompletely treated. We don't know all the answers, but MRSA infections certainly can recur.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Lily. Your line is open, Lily.
Yes, my question was that what do we do with families? That's always been when I'm trying to enforce the isolation precaution for contact, it's the families. Do we get them to wear gowns and gloves all the time when they're sitting in the patient's room? What is your opinion about that?
Well, I think that there are, again, no official guidance from the CDC on that. A couple of points to consider, and is that in transmission in the healthcare setting, transmission we think is largely occurs from patient to patient, patients being the major reservoir, via either the contaminated hands or clothing of healthcare workers or contaminated equipment. So the problem is mainly one of patient to patient transmission because healthcare workers and equipment go from patient to patient to patient in the hospital.
Yes.
It's a little bit different for families. They usually come in and
go out.
Visit with one patient and then they go out. Now, yes, it's possible that they may, you know, come in contact with things on their way out. But we think in general, those, you know, visitors are probably not huge reservoirs for transmission in the healthcare setting. So I think that there, you know, some judgment needs to be applied there. And I think you could, you know, some hospitals do plan, do that, you know, have anybody who enters the room take precautions. Some hospitals don't, and we don't have a real answer for that. But I would say that I think you could defend a program in which you don't have the visitors follow the exact same precautions as long as they're not having extensive contact with other patients or other healthcare workers in the facility.
Yes, I agree with you, and I know what the CDC guideline is, and then the other nurses say, how about we have to do it, and then the families don't. And then I have a personal concern about the community-acquired MRSA with the families coming in and going out. And don't you think that may contribute to community-acquired MRSA?
contribute to community-acquired MRSA.
If somebody's coming and don't use any precaution, I mean, we ask them to wash their hands and all that. But
most of the community-associated MRSA that we see are not caused by strains that have traditionally been associated with transmission in healthcare.
Yes, that's the difference. So all right, thank you very much. You answered my question. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dr. Jernigan, we have many more questions in line, so I'm going to ask that people send an email to COCA@cdc.gov, that's COCA@cdc.gov, if they were unable to get their question answered today. So maybe we have, I don't know if you have time for one more, and then we can wrap it up.
Sure.
Thank you.
Dr. Charles Arnett, your line is open.
Yes, my question is from a public health issue and working with the school systems and the control of MRSA. The boys and girls are taught to do skin inspections, but how about the little ones who are involved in wrestling, the preschool and the early school ages? Would it be good to advise parents to do a total body inspection for MRSA once in a while?
Well, I think it is important to educate families, including the parents of small children, on the issue of skin and soft tissue infections in general and other, you know, diseases that might be, you know, transmitted in settings where there's close contact, and to understand how to recognize signs and symptoms of early skin infection and to, you know, raise that with their healthcare worker if they are concerned. So, yes, I do think that education not only on recognition, but on the fact that simple hygiene measures really will go a long way towards preventing transmission.
Thank you.
Dr. Jernigan, thank you for providing our listeners with this information, and I want to thank our participants for joining us today. And as a reminder, if you didn't get a chance to ask your question, we apologize, and please send an email to COCA@cdc.gov. That's COCA@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to our COCA website. That's www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA as they come to us. You have 1 year to obtain continuing education credits for this call. All continuing education credits for COCA conference calls are issued online through the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System. So thank you again, and I hope everyone has a wonderful day.
This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you for your participation.